Chapter 4 Sumna. To be ignorant and to be deceived are two different things. To be ignorant is to be a slave of the world. To be deceived is to be the slave of another man. The question will always be, why, when all men are ignorant and therefore already slaves, does this latter slavery sting us so? Agensis, The Epistemologies. But despite stories of Fainim atrocities, the fact of the matter is that the Qiyanin, heathen or no, were surprisingly tolerant of Inrithi pilgrimages to Shima, before the Holy War, that is. Why would a people devoted to the destruction of the Tusk extend this courtesy to idolaters? Perhaps they were partially motivated by the prospect of trade, as others have suggested. But the fundamental motive lies in their desert heritage. The Qiyanin word for a holy place is Si'ikalis, which means literally great oasis. On the open desert, it is their strict custom to never begrudge travelers water, even if they be enemies. Drusus Acamian, Compendium of the First Holy War. The Holy War of the Inrithi against the Fainim was declared by Mathenet, the 116th Shriya of the Thousand Temples, on the morn of Ascension in 4110, year of the Tusk. The day had been unseasonably hot, as though the god himself had blessed the holy war with a premonition of summer. Indeed, the three seas buzzed with rumors of omens and visions, all of which attested to the sanctity of the task that lay before the Inrithi. Word spread. In every nation, priests in the shrile and cultic temples railed against the atrocities and iniquities of the Fainim. How, they asked, could the Inrithi call themselves faithful when the city of the latter prophet had been enslaved? Through invective and passionate harangue, the abstract sins of a distant exotic people were brought close to the congregations of the Inrithi and transformed into their own. To tolerate iniquity, they were told, was to cultivate wickedness. When a man failed to weed his garden, did he not grow weeds? And it seemed to the Inrithi that they had been stirred from a mercantile inertia, that they had suffered from an unaccountable sloth of spirit. How long would the gods endure a people who had made harlots of their hearts, who had allowed themselves to be numbed by venal ease? How long before the gods abandoned them, or worse yet, turned against them in bright wrath? In the streets of the great cities, vendors plied customers with rumors of this or that potentate declaring for the Tusk. And in the taverns, veterans argued over the comparative pieties of their lords. Called to the hearth, children listened wide-eyed, wrapped with awe and dread, as their fathers described how the Fainim, a foul and wretched people, had despoiled the purity of an impossibly wondrous place, Shima. They would awaken, shrieking in the middle of the night, blubbering about eyeless Kisharim, who saw through the heads of snakes. During the day, as they romped through the streets or the fields, little brothers would be forced to play the heathen so that their older siblings might trounce them with sword-like sticks. And in the dark, husbands would tell wives the latest news of the holy war, and speak in solemn whispers about the glory of the task the Shriya had set before them. And the wives would weep, quietly, because faith made strong, knowing that very soon their husbands would leave them. Shima. Men gnashed their teeth at the thought of this hallowed name, and it seemed to them that Shima had to be a hushed place, a ground that had held its breath for anguished centuries, waiting for the drowsy followers of the latter prophet at last to stir from their slumber and put right an ancient and heinous crime. They would come with sword and knife and cleanse that ground, and when the Fainim were dead, they would kneel and kiss the sweet earth that had begat the latter prophet. They would join the holy war. The Thousand Temples issued edicts stating that those who profited from the absence of any great lord who had taken up the Tusk would be tried for heresy in the ecclesiastical courts and summarily executed. Thus assured of their birthrights, princes, earls, palatines, and lords of every nation declared themselves men of the Tusk. Trivial wars were forgotten. Lands were mortgaged. Client knights were summoned by their thanes and barons. Indentured servants were provisioned with arms and housed in makeshift barracks. Great fleets of ships were contracted to make the journey by sea to Momen, where the Shrya had announced the holy war must gather. Mathanet had called, and the entire three seas had answered. The back of the heathen would be broken. Holy Shima would be cleansed. Mid-spring, 4110, Year of the Tusk, Sumna. Esmanet's daughter was never far from her thoughts. It was strange the way anything, even the most trivial happenstance, could summon memories of her. This time, it was Akamian and his curious habit of sniffing each prune before taking it between his teeth. Once her daughter had sniffed an apple at the market. It was a breathless memory, wan, as though rinsed of color by the horrific fact of her death. An adorable little girl, bright beneath the shadows of passers-by, with straight black hair, a chubby, tender face, and eyes like perpetual hope.
"Mama, it smells like..."
she had said, hooking her voice as insight failed her.
"It smells like water and flowers."
She flashed her mother a triumphant smile. Esmanet looked up at the sour vendor, who nodded at the entwined serpents tattooed on the back of her left hand. The message was clear. "I don't sell to your kind."
"That's funny, my sweet. It smells overpriced to me." "But Mama,"
her darling had said. Esmanet blinked the tears from her eyes. Akamian was speaking to her. "I find this difficult," he said with an air of confession. "I should have bought an apple somewhere else." They both sat on low stools in her room, next to her beaten knee-high table. The shutters were open, and the chill spring air seemed to exaggerate the sounds of the street below. Akamian had draped a wool blanket over his shoulders, but Esmanet was content to shiver. How long had Akamian stayed with her now? Long enough for them to feel safely bored with each other, she supposed, almost as though they were married. A spy like Akamian, she had realized, one who recruited and directed those who actually had access to knowledge, spent most of his time simply waiting for something to happen. And Akamian had waited here, in her impoverished room in an ancient tenement that housed dozens of other whores such as herself. It had been so strange at first. Many mornings she would lie awake, listening to the hideous sounds of him making mud in her pot. She would bury her head beneath sheets, insisting that he see a physician or a priest, only half-joking, because it really was hideous. He started calling it his morning apocalypse after she once cried more in exasperation than in good humor, "Just because you relive the apocalypse every night, Akka, doesn't mean that you have to share it with me in the morning." Akamian would chuckle ruefully while he cleaned himself, Mutter something about the merits of heavy drinking and clean bowels, and Esmanet would find as much comfort as hilarity in the sight of a sorcerer splashing water on his ass. She would get up, open the shutters, and sit half-naked on the sill as she always did, alternately gazing across the smoky clamor of Sumna and scanning the street below for possible custom. The two of them would eat a frugal breakfast of unleavened bread, sour cheese and the like, while talking about any number of things, the latest rumors regarding Mathanet, the venal hypocrisy of priests, the way teamsters could make even soldiers blush with their curses, and so on. And it would seem to Esmanet that they were happy, that in some strange way they belonged in this place at this time. Sooner or later, however, either someone would call up to her from the street or one of her regular patrons would knock at the door, and things would sour. Akamian would become grim, grab his cloak and satchel, and invariably go get drunk at some dingy tavern. Usually she would spy him from the sill when he returned, walking alone through the endless press of people, an aging, slightly rounded man who looked as though he'd lost his purse gambling. Every time, without exception, he would already be watching her when she saw him. He would wave, hesitantly, try to smile, and a pang of sorrow would strike her, sometimes so hard she would gasp aloud.
What was it she felt? Many things, it seemed. Pity for him, certainly. In the midst of strangers, Akamian always looked so lonely, so misunderstood. No one, she would often think, knows him the way I do. There was also relief that he'd returned to her, even though he had gold enough to buy far younger whores. A selfish sorrow, that one. And shame. Shame because she knew that he loved her, and that every time she took custom, it bruised his heart. But what choice did she have? He would never come up to their room unless he saw her on the sill. One time after being beaten by a particularly nasty fiend who claimed to be a coppersmith, she'd simply crawled into bed and wept herself to sleep. She awoke before dawn and hastened to the window when she realized Akamian hadn't returned. She huddled there for hours, waiting for him, watching the sun bronze the sea and then lance through the misty city. The first potter's wheels growled to life on the adjoining street, and the first trails of kiln and cooking smoke twined above rooftops into bluing sky. She cried softly, but even then she let one breast fall free from her blankets as though she were a nursing mother, and allowed one long pale leg to hang down against the cold brick so that those looking up might glimpse the shadowy promise between her knees. And then finally, as the sun began to warm her face and bare shoulder, she heard a tap at the door. She flew across the room and wrenched it open, and there was the disheveled sorcerer.
Akka,
she cried, tears spilling from her eyes. He glanced at her and then to the empty bed, told her he'd fallen asleep outside her door, and she had known then that she truly loved him. Theirs was a strange marriage, if it could be called that. A marriage of outcasts, sanctified by inarticulate vows, a sorcerer and a whore. Perhaps a certain desperation was to be expected of such unions, as though that strange word, love, became profound in proportion to the degree one was scorned by others. Esmanette wrapped her shoulders in her arms. She studied Akamian with an impatient sigh.
What?
She asked wearily.
What do you find difficult, Akka?
Akamian turned his injured eyes away, said nothing. When he had learned what the coppersmith had done, he'd been outraged. He fairly dragged her to several smithies, demanding she identify the man. And though she protested, claimed that such assaults were simply part of the custom she collected from the street, she was secretly thrilled, and part of her hoped that he would burn the man to cinders. For the first time, perhaps, she understood Akamian could do that, and had done it in the past. But they had never found the man. She suspected that Akamian had continued prowling the smithies looking for someone who fit her description of the man, and she had no doubt that Akamian would have murdered him if he'd found him. He had continued talking about him long after the incident, pretending to be gallant when in fact, or so Esmanette had suspected, some small part of him wanted to murder all of her custom.
Why do you stay here, Akamian?
She asked, a small hostility in her voice. He looked at her angrily, and his question was plain. Why do you still sleep with them, Esme? Why do you insist on remaining a whore while I stay with you?
Because sooner or later you'll leave me, Akka, and the men who feed me will have found different whores.
But before he could speak, there was a shy knock at her door.
I'll leave, Akamian said, standing. A bolt of terror passed through her.
When will you be back?
She asked, struggling not to sound desperate.
After, he said. After.
He offered her the blanket, which she took in knotted hands. She had clenched everything with a strange fierceness lately, as though daring small things to be glass. She watched him answer the door.
Inrao, Akamian said.
What are you doing here?
I've learned something important,
the young man said breathlessly.
Come in, come in,
Akamian said, ushering the priest to his stool.
I'm afraid I wasn't that careful,
Inrao said, avoiding both of their looks.
I may have been followed.
Akamian studied him a moment, then shrugged. Even if you've been followed, it's no matter. Priests have a pension for prostitutes.
Is that true, Esmanette?
Inrao said with a nervous smile. Her presence, as Manette knew, made him uncomfortable, and like many kind men, he attempted to cover for his embarrassment with strained humor.
They're much like sorcerers that way, she said wryly.
Akamian shot her a look of mock indignation, and Inrao laughed nervously. So, tell us, Akamian said, his eyes betraying his smile. What have you learned? A look of childlike concentration flashed across Inrao's face. He was dark-haired and slender, clean-shaven, with large brown eyes and feminine lips. He possessed, as Manette thought, the attractive vulnerability of young men in the shadow of the world's bitter hammers. Such men were highly prized by whores, and not only because they tended to pay for damage done as much as for pleasure received. They offered compensation of a different sort. Such men might be safely loved, the way mothers love tender sons.
I can see why you fear for him so, Akka.
Gathering his breath, Inrao said,
The Scarlet Spires has agreed to join the Holy War.
Akamian knitted his brow. This is a rumor you've heard?
I suppose. He paused. But I was told by an orate from the College of Luthime. I guess Mathanet made his offer some time ago. In order to demonstrate that it wasn't frivolous, he actually sent 6 trinkets to Carathusel as a gesture of goodwill. Since the Luthime have great powers over the dispensation of Kore, Mathanet was compelled to give them an explanation.
So it's true, then?
It's true.
Inrao looked at him the way a hungry man who has found a foreign coin might look at a money changer.
How much is this worth?
Excellent. Excellent. This is indeed important news. Inrao's elation was contagious, and Esmanette found herself smiling with him.
You've done good, Inrao, she said.
Indeed, Akamian added. The Scarlet Spires, Esme, is the most powerful school in the 3 Seas, rulers of High Anon since the last Scholastic War. But too many questions seemed to crowd his thoughts for him to continue. Akamian had always been inclined to give fatuous explanations. He knew full well that she knew of the Scarlet Spires. But Esmanette forgave him this. In a sense, his explanations were a measure of his desire to include her in his life. In so many ways, Akamian was utterly unlike other men.
6 trinkets, he blurted. A most extraordinary gift. Priceless.
Is that why she loved him? The world seemed so small, so sordid, when she was alone. And when he returned, it seemed as though he bore the entire 3 Seas upon his back. She led a submerged life, a life catacombed by poverty and ignorance. Then this soft-hearted, portly man would arrive, a man who looked even less like a spy than he did a sorcerer. And for a time, the roof of her life would be torn away, and sun and world would come pouring in.
I do love you, Drusus Akamian.
Trinkets, Esme. For the 1,000 temples, they're the very tears of God. To give 6 of them to a school of blasphemers? Remarkable. He combed his beard as he thought, his fingers tracing its 5 silver streaks and then tracing them again.
Trinkets.
This reminded Esmanette that despite the wonder, Akamian's world was exceedingly deadly. Ecclesiastical law dictated that prostitutes, like adulteresses, be punished by stoning. The same, she reflected, was true of sorcerers, except there was just one kind of stone that could afflict them, and it need touch them only once. Thankfully, there were few trinkets. The world, on the other hand, was filled with stones for harlots.
Why, though?
Inrao asked, a measure of grief now in his voice.
Why would Mathanet pollute the Holy War by inviting a school?
How difficult this must be for him, Esmanette thought, to be pinned between men like Akamian and Mathanet. Because he must, Akamian replied. Otherwise the Holy War would be doomed. Remember that the Kishorim reside in Shaima.
But Kore are as lethal to them as they are to sorcerers.
Perhaps, but that makes little difference in a war such as this. Before the Holy War could bring their trinkets to bear on the Kisharim, it would have to overcome the hosts of Kian. No, Mathanet needs a school.
Such a war,
Esmenet thought. In her youth, her soul had quickened whenever she heard stories of war, and even now she commonly plied the soldiers she pleasured for stories of battle. For a moment, she could almost see the tumult, see swords flash in the light of sorcerous fire.
And the Scarlet Spires, Akamian continued. There could be no better school for him to—
No school more hateful, Inral protested. The mandate, Esmenet knew, reserved a special hatred for the Scarlet Spires. No school, Akamian had once told her, more begrudged the mandate their possession of the Gnosis.
The Tusk doesn't discriminate between abominations, Akamian replied. Obviously, Mathanet made his overture for strategic reasons. There's talk that the Emperor already moves to make the Holy War his instrument of reconquest. By allying himself with the Scarlet Spires, Mathanet need not depend on the Emperor's school, the Imperial sake. Think of what the House Aikyori would make of his Holy War. The Emperor. For some reason, his mention drew Esmenet's eyes to the two copper talents resting on her table, one askew upon the other, with their miniature profiles of Aikyori Zarius III, the Emperor of Nansur, her emperor. Like all the inhabitants of Sumna, she never really thought of him as her ruler, even though his soldiers provided her with almost as much custom as the Shrial priests. The Shrya was too near, she supposed. But then, not even the Shrya meant much to her.
I am too small, she thought. Then a question occurred to her. Shouldn't— Esmenet began, but she paused when the two men looked at her strangely. Shouldn't the question be, why have the Scarlet Spires accepted Mathanet's offer? What could induce a school to join a holy war? They make for odd bedfellows, don't you think? Not so long ago, Akka, you feared that the holy war would be declared against the schools.
There was a moment of silence. Inrao smiled as though amused by his own stupidity. From this moment on, Esmenet realized, Inrao would look upon her as an equal in these matters.
Akamian, however, would remain aloof, the judge of all questions, as was proper, perhaps, given his calling. There are several reasons, actually, Akamian said at length. Before leaving Carathuzel, I learned that the Scarlet Spires has been warring, secretly, against the sorcerer priests of the Fenum, the Kisharum, warring for 10 bitter years. He momentarily bit his lip.
For some reason, the Kisharum assassinated Sashioka,
who was then Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires.
Eleazarus, Sashioka's pupil, is Grand Master now.
He was rumored to be close to Sashioka, close in the manner of Enani men.
Inrao said, so the Scarlet Spires
hopes to avenge itself, Akamian said, completing his protege's thought, to conclude their secret war. But there's more. None of the schools understands the metaphysics of the Kisharum, the Sukha. All of them, even the School of Mandate, are terrified by the fact that it cannot be seen as sorcery.
Why does not seeing terrify you so much?
Esmenet asked. This was but one of many small questions she had never dared ask.
Why? Akamian repeated, suddenly very serious. You ask this, Esmenet, because you've no idea of the power we wield, no inkling of how far out of proportion it is to the frailty of our bodies. Sashioka was slain precisely because he could not distinguish the work of the Kisharum from the works of the god.
Esmenet scowled. She turned to Inrao. Does he do this to you?
You mean fault the question rather than answer?
Inrao said wryly.
All the time.
But Akamian's expression darkened.
Listen to me carefully. This isn't a game we play. Any of us, but especially you, Inrao, could end up with our heads boiled in salt, tarred and posted before the Vault of the Tusk. And there's more at stake than even our lives, far more.
Esmenet fell silent, faintly shocked by the reprimand. There were times, she realized, when she forgot the depths of Drusus Akamian. How many times had she held him after he'd awakened from one of his dreams? How many times had she heard him mutter strange tongues in his sleep? She glanced at him and saw that the anger in his eyes had been replaced by pain.
I don't expect either of you to understand the stakes involved. I even grow tired of listening to myself prattle on about the consult. But something is different this time. I know it pains you to consider this, Inrao, but your Maethanet, he's not my Maethanet. He doesn't belong to anyone, and that...
Inrao hesitated, as though troubled by his own ardor.
That's what makes him worthy of my devotion. Perhaps I don't fully understand the stakes, as you say, but I know more than most. And I worry, Akka, I honestly worry that this is simply another fool's errand.
As Inrao said this, he glanced, involuntarily as Manette supposed, at the serpentine mark of the whore tattooed across the back of her hand. She bundled her fists under crossed arms. Then, unaccountably, the real mystery behind these events struck her. She looked at each man in turn, her eyes wide.
Inrao glanced down. Akamian, however, watched her keenly.
He knows, Esmonette thought. He knows that I have a gift for these things.
What is it, Esme?
You say that the Mandate only just learned of the Scarlet Spire's war against the Kisharim?
Yes.
She found herself leaning forward, as though these words were something best whispered.
If the Scarlet Spires can keep such a thing secret from the Mandate for 10 years, Akka, then how is it that Maethanet, a man who has only recently become Shrya, knows?
What do you mean? Inrao asked with alarm.
No, Akamian said thoughtfully. She's right. There's no way Maethanet would even approach the Scarlet Spires unless he knew the school warred against the Kisharim. It would be too absurd otherwise. The proudest school in the Three Seas joining a holy war? Think about it. How could he know?
Perhaps, Inrao offered, the Thousand Temples simply stumbled across the knowledge. Like you did, only earlier.
Perhaps, Akamian repeated, but unlikely. At the very least, this demands we watch him more closely.
Esmonette shivered yet again, but this time with exhilaration.
The world turns about people such as these, and I've just joined them.
The air, she thought, smelled of water and flowers. Inrao looked momentarily at Esmonette before turning his plaintive eyes to his mentor.
I can't do what you ask. I can't.
You must get closer to Maethanet, Inrao. Your Shrya is altogether too canny.
What?
The young priest said with half-hearted sarcasm.
Too canny to be a man of faith?
Not at all, my friend. Too canny to be what he seems.
Late spring, 4110, year of the tusk, Sumna.
Rain. If a city was old, really old, the gutters and pools would always glitter black, sodden by the detritus of ages. Sumna was ancient, her waters like pitch. Hugging himself, Paro Inrao scanned the dark courtyard. He was alone. Everywhere he could hear the sound of water, the dull roar of rain, the gurgle of eaves, and the slap of gutters. Through the wash he could hear the supplicant's wail. Arched into shapes of pain and sorrow, their song rang across the wet stone and cupped his thoughts in stretched notes, hymns of suffering. Two voices, one pitched high and plaintive, asking why we must suffer, always why. The other, low, filled with the brooding grandeur of the Thousand Temples and bearing the gravity of truth, that men were at one with suffering and ruin, that tears were the only holy waters.
My life, he thought. My life.
Inrao lowered his face, tried to grimace away his weeping. If only he could forget. If only.
The Shrya. But how could it be?
So lonely. Around him, Canaan stoneworks loomed, piled away into the dark vastness of the Hagurna. He slid to a crouch and rocked against the wet stone. Fear this encompassing gave one no direction to run. He could only shrink inside, try to weep himself away into nothing.
Akamian, dear teacher. What have you done to me?
When Inrao thought of his years at Ursus, studying under the watchful eyes of Drusus Akamian,
He remembered those times he'd gone out with his father and uncle to cast nets far from the Neroni shore, those times when the clouds had grown dark and his father, heaving the silvery fish from the sea, had refused to return to the village.
"Look at this catch!"
he would cry, his eyes frenzied by desperate good fortune.
"Momus favors us, lads! The god favors us!"
At Ursus reminded Inrau of those perilous times, not because Akamian resembled his father. No, his father had been strong, his legs bowed to the deck, his spirit indomitable before the pitching sea. But because, like the fish, the riches he'd drawn from sorcery's bosom had been purchased against the threat of doom. To Inrau, at Ursus had seemed a violent storm frozen in soaring pillars and black curtains of stone. And Akamian had resembled his uncle, subdued before his father's wrath, and yet striving ever harder to catch their fill so that he might save both his brother and his brother's son. He owed his life to Drusus Akamian. Inrau was certain of this. The schoolmen of the Mandate never returned to the shore, and they killed those who abandoned their nets to do so. How did men repay such debts? With monies owed, a man simply returned the money borrowed with a usurer's interest. What was given and what was returned were the same. But was the exchange this simple when a man owed his life to another? For returning him to shore, did Inrau owe Akamian one last voyage into stormy Mandate seas? To repay Akamian in the same coin he owed seemed wrong somehow, as though his old teacher had simply rescinded his gift, rather than asking for a gift in return. Inrau had made many exchanges in his life. By leaving the Mandate for the Thousand Temples, he traded the heartbreak of Seswatha for the tragic beauty of Inri Sejanus, the terror of the consult for the hatred of the Kisharim, and the condescending dismissal of faith for the pious condemnation of sorcery. And he had asked himself in those early days what it was that he'd gained by this exchange of callings. Everything. He'd gained everything. Faith for knowledge, wisdom for cunning, heart for intellect. There were no scales for this, only men and their many-colored inclinations. Inrau had been born for the Thousand Temples, and by allowing him to leave the School of Mandate, Akamian had given him everything. And because of this, the gratitude Inrau bore his old teacher was beyond measure or description. Any price, he would think as he wandered through the Hagurna, besotted by relief and joy. Any price. And now the storm had come. He felt small, like a boy abandoned to dark, heaving seas. Please, let me forget this. For an instant, he thought he could hear the sound of boots echoing down one of the alleyways. But then the summoning horn sounded, impossibly deep, like ocean surf heard through a stone wall. He hurried across the courtyard toward the immense temple doors, pulling his cloak against the downpour. The doors of the Ireuma grated open, throwing a broad lane of light across cobblestones sizzling with rain. Careful to avoid curious eyes, he shouldered through the sudden crowds of priests and monks who filed from the temple. He sprinted up the broad steps between the bronze serpents that graced the entrance. The doorkeeper scowled as he entered. At first he cringed, but then he realized he had tracked water and grit across their floor. He ignored them. Before him, two rows of columns formed a broad aisle haphazardly illuminated by hanging braziers. The columns soared up to support the clerestory, the raised central section of the roof, too high for the light to reach. To either side of the clerestory aisle were two more rows of lesser columns, flanking the small godhouses of various cultic deities. Everything seemed to be reaching, reaching. He placed an absent hand on the limestone. Cool, impassive, no sign of the great load borne. Such was the strength of inanimate things.
Give me this strength, goddess. Make me as a pillar.
Inrau traced a circle around the column and walked into the shadow of her godhouse, felt soothed by her cool stone.
Uncas, beloved.
God has a thousand faces, Sejanus had said, but men, only one heart.
Every great faith was a labyrinth possessed of innumerable small grottos, half-secret places where the abstractions fell away and where the objects of worship became small enough to comfort daily anxieties, familiar enough to weep openly about petty things. Inrau had found his grotto in the shrine of Ancus, the singer in the dark, the aspect who stood at the heart of all men, moving them to forever grasp far more than they could hold. He knelt. Sobs racked him. If only he could have forgotten what the mandate had taught him. If he could have done that, then this last heartbreaking revelation would have been meaningless to him. If only a Kamian had not come. The price was too high. Uncas. Could she forgive him for returning to the mandate? The idol was worked in white marble, eyes closed with the sunken look of the dead. At first glance, she appeared to be the severed head of a woman, beautiful, yet vaguely common, mounted on a pole. Anything more than a glance, however, revealed the pole to be a miniature tree, like those cultivated by the ancient Norserai, only worked in bronze. Branches poked through her parted lips and swept across her face, nature reborn through human lips. Other branches reached behind to break through her frozen hair. Her image never failed to stir something within him, and this is why he always returned to her. She was this stirring, the dark place where the flurries of his thought arose. She came before him. He started at the sound of voices from the direction of the temple gate. Doorkeepers. Must be. Then he fumbled with his cloak and produced a small satchel of food, dried apricots, dates, almonds, and some salted fish. He came close enough that she might feel the warmth of his breath and, with trembling hands, placed the food in a small trough gouged from her pedestal. All food had its essence, its animus, what the blasphemers called the anta. Everything cast shadows across the outside where the gods moved. With shaking hands, he pulled out his humble ancestor lists and whispered the names, pausing to beg his great-grandfather to intercede on his behalf. "Strength," he murmured. "Please, strength." The small scroll clattered to the floor. The silence was complete, oppressive. His heart ached. So much was at stake. These were the events upon which the world turned. Enough for a goddess. "Please, speak to me." Nothing. Tears branched across his face. He raised his arms, held them open until his shoulders burned. "Anything," he cried. "Run," his thoughts whispered. "Run." Such a coward. How could he be such a coward? Something behind him. The sound of flapping wings, like the flutter of cloth among the towering pillars. He turned his face to the shadowy ceiling, searching with his ears. Another flutter, somewhere up in the clerestory. His skin prickled. "Is that you?" "No." Always doubting. Why was he always doubting? Stumbling to his feet, he hastened from the godhouse. The temple gate had been closed, and the doorkeepers were nowhere to be seen. In a few moments, he located the narrow stair that led up through the wall to the clerestory balconies. Midway up the stair, the darkness became pitch. He paused for a moment and breathed deeply. The air smelled of dust. The uncertainty, always so powerful in him, was snuffed out. "It's you." His head was buzzing with rapture by the time he crested the stairs. The door to the balcony was ajar. Grayish light sifted through the opening. Finally, after all his love, all his time, Uncas would sing to him instead of through. Tentatively, he stepped out onto the balcony. He licked his lips, his stomach leaping. He could hear the roar of the rainfall through the stone. The pillar capitals were the first things to resolve from the gloom, then the ceiling looming close above. It seemed unnatural for so much weight to be suspended so high. The trunks of the columns gradually grew brighter as they fell out of sight. The light from below was distant and diffuse, as soft as the worn edges of the stonework.
The balcony railing had an aura of dizziness, so he kept his back to the wall. The masonry seemed brittle, chapped, ancient in the gloom. The wall frescoes had fallen off in sloughs. The ceiling was encrusted with hundreds of clay hornets' nests, and he was reminded of the barnacled hulls of warships hauled onto beach sand.
"Where are you?"
he whispered. Then he saw it, and horror throttled him. It stood a short distance away, perched on the railing, watching him with shiny blue eyes. It had the body of a crow, but its head was small, bald, and human, about the size of a child's fist. Stretching thin lips over tiny, perfect teeth, it smiled.
"Sweet Sejanus. Oh, God, it can't be, can't be!"
A parody of surprise flashed across the miniature face.
"You know what I am,"
it said in a papery voice.
"How?"
"Can't be, cannot be. Consult here. No, no, no."
"Because," another voice replied, "he was once one of Akamian's students."
The speaker had been concealed in the shadows farther down the clerestory. He now walked into the dim light. Cutius Sarcella smiled in greeting.
"Weren't you, Inrao?
A knight commander consorting with a consult synthes?
Akka, Akka, save me!"
Nightmarish terror and disbelief, stealing breath, panicking thought. Inrao staggered backward. The floor reeled. The sound of iron grating against stone behind him made him cry out. He whirled and saw another shrial knight stride from the darkness. He knew this one as well. Mujanish, who had accompanied him on tithe collections in the past. The man approached, his stance wary and his arms wide as though he herded a dangerous bull.
"What was happening? Ancus?"
"As you can see,"
the crow-bodied synthes said,
"there's no place for you to go."
"Who?"
Inrao managed to gasp. He could see the mark of sorcery now. The scar tissue of the cants used to bind someone's soul to the abominable vessel before him. How had he missed it?
"He knows this form is but a shell,"
the synthes said to Sarcellus.
"But I don't see Chigra within him."
The pea-sized eyes, little beads of sky-blue glass, turned to Inrao.
"Boy? You don't dream the dream like the others, do you? If you did, you would recognize me. Chigra never failed to recognize me."
"Ancus? Treacherous god-bitch!"
Through the terror, an impossible certainty seized him. A revelation. Words of prayer had become tissue. Beneath, he sensed other words. Words of power.
"What do you want?"
Inrao asked, his voice steadier this time.
"What are you doing here?"
He cared nothing for the answer and everything for the time.
Please remember.
"Doing? Why, what our kind always does, overseeing our stake in these affairs."
It pursed its lips over its tiny teeth, but sourly, as though displeased by their taste.
"No different, I suppose, from what you were doing in the Shrier's apartments,
Breathing had become painful. He could not speak.
"Yes, yes, yes, that's it, that's it. But what comes next? What comes after?"
"Tisk, tisk,"
Sarcellus said, edging closer.
"I'm afraid this is partly my fault, old father. Some weeks ago I bid the young apostle to be industrious." "So it is your fault,"
the synthes said with a miniature mockery of a scowl. It clicked several feet down the railing to follow Inrao's retreat.
"Without direction, he simply threw his ardor into the wrong vocation, spying on the god rather than praying to him."
A small snort, like a cat sneeze.
"Ah, you see, Inrao, you've absolutely nothing to fear. The knight commander bears the responsibility."
"That's it, that's it, that's it."
Inrao sensed Mujanish looming behind. Prayer seized his tongue. Blasphemy tumbled from his lips. Turning with sorcerous speed, he punched two fingers through Mujanish's chainmail, cracked his breastbone, then seized his heart. He yanked his hand free, drawing a cord of glittering blood into the air. More impossible words. The blood burst into incandescent flame, followed his sweeping hand toward the synthes. Shrieking, the creature dove from the railing into emptiness, blinding beads of blood cracked bare stone. He would have turned to Sarcellus, but the sight of Mujanish stilled him. The shrile knight had stumbled to his knees, wiping his bloody hands on his surcoat. Then, as though spilling from a bladder, his face simply fell apart, dropping outward, unclutching. No mark, not the faintest whisper of sorcery. But how? Something struck him hard about the head, and he toppled, scrambling. A blow to his stomach sent him rolling. He glimpsed Sarcellus's shadowy form dancing about him. He gasped more words, words of shelter. Ghostly wards leapt about him. But they were useless. Reaching through the luminescent panes as though they were smoke, the knight commander seized him about the throat and heaved him into the air. He raised a koray in his other hand, whisked it over Inrau's cheek. Searing agony. The stone floor slammed into Inrau's face. He clutched at the pane. The skin flaked away beneath his fingers, transformed into salt by the koray's touch. The exposed flesh burned. He cried out again.
You will relent,
he heard the synthes cry. Never. Glaring at the hateful thing, Inrau resumed his blasphemous song. He saw the sun shining through the windows of its face. Too late. Lights like a thousand hooks lanced from the synthes' mouth. Inrau's wards cracked and splintered in a blinding chatter. Then his song was choked from his lips. The air smothered him with the density of water. He floated off the clerestory floor. Streams of silvery bubbles were drawn from his gaping mouth to break against the ceiling. The weight of an ocean crushed him with an embalming fist. At first, he was calm. He watched the synthes land on the knight's shoulder and regard him with tiny blue button eyes. He admired the black of its feathers, shot through with glassy hints of purple. He thought of Akamian, hapless, oblivious to the peril. Oh, Akka, it's worse than you dared imagine. But there was nothing to be done. His throat tightening, Inrau's thoughts turned to the goddess, to her infidelities, and to his. But his heart pounded more and more pressure into his skull until his lips curled and opened. Then he collapsed into thrashing madness, his idiot thoughts sure that somewhere there was some surface to break, some opening to air. A raw, irresistible reflex opened his lungs. Gagging convulsions, water like a sock in his throat, jerking in a haze of white beads. Then hard floor, coughing, burning, choking air. Sarcellus dragged him to his knees by his hair, wrenched his face toward the hazy blur of the synthes. Inrau vomited, hacked more fire out of his lungs.
I'm an old name, the tiny face said. Even wearing this shell, I could show you the agonies, mandate fool.
What?
Inrau swallowed, sobbed.
Why?
Again the thin, tiny smile.
You worship suffering. Why do you think?
Monumental rage filled him. It didn't understand. It didn't understand. With a coughing roar, he lurched forward, yanking his hair from his scalp. The synthes seemed to flicker out of his path, but it wasn't its death he sought. Any price, old teacher. The stone rail slammed against his hips, broke like cake. Again he was floating, but it was so different. Air whipping across his face, bathing his body. With a single outstretched hand, Paro Inrau followed a pillar to the earth.